to the general manager. In 1953, he was the secretary and trustee of Tektronix Foundation, became a vice president in 1954, and he's been a vice president ever since. Some of the he's got a real interesting experiences outside of Tektronix. He's very active in civic activities and other business activities. He's the director of Lincoln Savings and Loan Association and Investors Insurance Company. He's the director of Portland Chamber of Commerce and Portland Junior Symphony Association, United Way of Portland, and the Oregon Partners of the Americas, and trustee of Willamette University, Oregon Independent College Foundation, Independent College Funds of America, and Meridian Park Hospital. So he's a very active person. At this time, I'd like to have Bill come up.
Thanks, Gary, and thanks to the panel for inviting me. When you talk about a history of Tektronix, you think about dates and statistics, but I lean toward more people, and this is going to be more reminiscences, and it's my version of what happened. It's always very interesting for me to talk about Tektronix. I thoroughly enjoy it. It's fun, and I hope that I can give you something of worthwhile. My motive, as far as you're concerned, is hoping that you will feel a little bit closer to the heritage of Tektronix when we're through. Now, this is strictly from my personal viewpoint. Maybe no one else would agree with me. To keep all this honest, I asked the panel, and they agreed, if I could bring a resource person with me today. And since they very nicely agreed, I brought Howard Vollum with me as a resource person. He'll keep me honest. Yeah. Now, I conned Howard into coming by promising him that he didn't have to say anything unless it got to the point of where he just couldn't stand it any longer as to what I'm saying and wanted a rebuttal. But if time permits, we can give him an opportunity at the end if he wishes to make a comment or if anyone has a specific question. I'll try and not block out these pictures. What we're trying to do is to give you something to look at other than me while I'm doing the talking. And the one on your right is Jack Murdoch, and of course Howard doesn't have to be identified because most of you have an opportunity to see him around here from time to time. In talking about Tektronix, I'd like to go back to the very beginning, something that's the heart of our business, and that's the occasion in 1897 when Carl Braun was granted a patent on the cathode ray tube. And because we felt that that was such a significant event in our heritage, we named our mainstream road out here Carl Braun Drive. The other roads are named after people who were very prominent in the electronics industry. Tech Week and other places have a series of articles on the individuals those roads are named after, and they're available to you people anytime you're interested. The next significant event was along about 1930, when the cathode ray tube became commercialized or commercially available in the United States. This was done through Alan B. Dumont and through RCA. That made it possible, when the cathode ray tube became available, then eventually to have, in addition to oscilloscopes, television and radar. Also, coming along at that time was rather fortuitous because Howard was college age in the early mid-30s, and a commercially available CRT made it possible for Howard to take that on as a personal interest, completely educating himself from the standpoint of designing and building an oscilloscope. Also, in those days when we spoke of electronics, we really meant radio or something connected with radio. Electronics and radio was almost synonymous. Jack Murdoch, too, was very much interested in radio and electronics. He had that as one of his major interests when he was growing up. As a matter of interest, I'd like to read a quotation which is actually an autobiography of Jack. Some of you people may have seen this before, but to refresh your memories, I'd like to read it. It was written by him in his early years. Quote, "After leaving high school and establishing a business of my own, I intend to go further into the study of radio phenomena. I would like to learn all there is to know about radio, if it is possible. I shall probably carry on many experiments in this field, and also possibly some other branches of science. If I do all that I hope to do, I shall probably make some inventions. I have at present several ideas for inventions, which, if put to use, would be of great benefit to the people of the world. I believe that the possibilities of radio are unlimited, and that the majority of the people have no idea of what radio's future holds in store." Jack graduated from Franklin High School and immediately started his own business. This was with the encouragement of his father, who had a little bit of money set aside to help him go to college or to start his own business, and his father wisely gave him a choice. Jack chose to take the money and go in business. He had an electrical appliance business and then a radio sales and service business. And it was through that business that Howard and Jack became acquainted. Howard joined Jack in that business, handling the radio sales and service end of Jack's general appliance business. Along about early 40s, Howard won the biggest lottery there was. Howard used to say that that's the only time he ever won anything in his life was when he won the selective service lottery and was drafted very early into the Army. While he was a GI, he was, among other things, repairing the general's radio, and the general got awfully mad when Howard received a direct commission as an officer in the Signal Corps because of having graduated in physics from Reed College. And this was common at that time. Because of radar, there is a very severe shortage of officers in the military with a good, solid electronics background. Howard was one of those early ones, given a commission and shipped off to England because England had a considerably higher amount of radar experience at that stage of the game than we did in the United States. Howard was in England at a time before there were, based upon explanations from other friends of ours who were in England, before they were wearing uniforms, before it was known that the United States military personnel were in England. We weren't supposed to be at war. Nevertheless, the United States military personnel were there and were in some hazardous locations in spite of the fact we weren't at war. Howard had a very interesting experience in England. He worked at a laboratory, a radar development laboratory, and he participated on a personal basis in the design of a coast-watching radar, which I understand was credited with stopping the Germans from using the English Channel. when he returned to the United States in along about 1943 to the Evans Signal Laboratory, he received a Legion of Merit medal for his personal contributions to the design of the of equipment in the radar effort while in England. Also in 1943 at the Evans Signal Laboratory was where I first became acquainted with him. So that goes back now to a period of about 35 years that I have been associated with Howard one way or another. Jack, at that period of time, volunteered for military duty and was taken into the Coast Guard. And Jack worked in electronics in the Coast Guard in the Pacific Northwest during the war. When the war was over and everyone started adjusting to a civilian life, Jack and Howard decided they wanted to live in Portland. They wanted to go in business together, and they decided to start Tektronics because Howard felt that he had a considerable amount of technical information that was available to him during the war that clearly indicated that it was readily possible to design an oscilloscope and build an oscilloscope that was considerably better than any then currently available. Also, Howard received a cluster to the Legion of Merit Medal because of his personal contribution in the design of radar equipment while at the Evans Signal Laboratory during the war. I indicate this to indicate the general background of both people. Jack's background was also electronics, but because of his business, in the appliance business, he switched over into more of the business areas of the functions rather than the technical areas of the company, because he had a very sincere and abiding interest in people. Jack, as a personality, was a very quiet individual. He avoided the limelight. He was very straightforward. He was a good listener. He was very much interested in how people acted as they did and why people didn't act more rationally. He felt that if everybody lived on the same principles that he based his life and everyone had the same same information on any given subject, there'd be no question but what there'd be immediate agreement. Well, he was puzzled over that, and he spent many, many years trying to understand people better. But it was a very simple philosophy that he had. And basically, it was just trying to treat people the way he'd like to be treated. But to clarify this one step further, I'd like to read some other words. This is about Jack, and these words will be familiar to Howard because he wrote them, not for the purpose of this, but a few years ago. Jack was a modest and unassuming man with no taste for the limelight, yet he was warm and outgoing, a person you could bring your problems to. Jack was always oriented toward the customer's viewpoint and toward the ideal of service. Both these characteristics were transmitted to Tektronix. He led by setting an example. Despite his achievements, he was a humble man, without pretense. He always felt that knowledge was the key to solving any problem. And if you knew enough about it, you could arrive at the appropriate solution. Well, this brings us up to 1946, when Tektronix officially got started. January of 1946, that most of you have read, with $20,000 worth of capitalization. And it was initially called TechRad as a coined word, phonetic spelling. And I'll refer you to an item in the a question in the agenda that we answered about that name and about the name of Tektronix. As it later turned out, it was probably fortunate that we did change the name from TechRad to Tektronix, because it's just a little bit more appropriate with the change in technology, where electronics is far, far broader than just communication. At the time Tektronix was started, there's a very high risk element. It started basically as a partnership between Jack and Howard, and then there were some smaller shareholders. All of the shareholders were involved in the same risk. The people that worked there at the beginning, well, as far as the founders were concerned, they contributed everything they had in energy, intellect, money. It was a very solid group effort, and the risks were very high. They probably weren't all that high in their minds, but there was a long, hard, dry spell of a struggle from the beginnings in 1946 until 1948, when it became profitable, or until virtually the middle of 1947, when they shipped their first instruments. It's hard to describe those years of hardship. I know that a personal friend of mine lived next door to one of the small shareholders, and they used to have to invite him over for dinner two or three nights a week in order for him literally to eat. At the risk of breach of confidence, Howard won't appreciate this, but Howard lived with his family, and Jack lived with his family. And had that not been possible, maybe Tektronix would never have gotten started, because it was a long, long dry spell where they committed all of their funds available. And there were many, many sacrifices. One of the great tragedies were that the parents of Howard and Jack were not around long enough to really see Tektronix blossom, to see the benefits of what the sacrifices resulted. I think maybe I better stop at this point, Gary, and have a break and pick it up. Okay. Emphasize the risk and the sacrifices that it took. I don't know whether I was overplaying it or not. It kind of reminded me of the movie Dr. Zhivago, you know, where they go across the snow and and on and on and on, or some movie in the desert, or where they go across the sands of the desert forever and ever. But I wanted to emphasize that, because now in our terms of greater affluence, we need to think back and remember that Tektronix never would have been had it not been for some very severe sacrifices and long dry spells for the people that started it. At that time, as you know, the Tektronix was located in a building that Jack Murdoch had out near Southeast Foster Road. And the first time Tektronix had a building of its own was in 1947, March of 47, when they moved into a building at Southeast 7th and Hawthorne an L-shaped building, two floors, 5,500 square feet on each floor. That was the first time they had a home, and that consisted of just one or two rooms up on the second floor of that building. The first floor of the building was occupied by Hawthorne Electronics, which the same people that owned Tektronics started also Hawthorne Electronics. And that was a means of helping them eat, because they could sell and service radios, marine electronics, industrial electronics, and so that was a side business. It became split off of Tektronics about 1949, where one of the original smaller shareholders took Hawthorne Electronics off by himself, and he continued to be the manufacturer's representative selling Tektronics equipment in the Northwest. In addition to Tektronics on the second floor, there were about three other tenants in this 5,500 square foot space. That didn't last long. As 1948 was the first full year of sales. The end of 48, there were about 32 employees. Also, at the very beginning, in the first full years of operation of in 1948, they started what was called a production bonus. This was a means of having everyone share in the economic benefits of it being a good-going concern. And they felt the first reaction was to pay extra on the basis of units shipped. But that was modified before too long to convert over to a profit-sharing plan, where everyone shared in the profits of Tektronics, and at that time it was a 25% profit-sharing plan. That is 25% of profits before taxes measured by income. At that time, when Tektronics was in its very early years, we were using suppliers from all over. But it wasn't long before we learned that it was necessary to start doing things ourselves. And so with this feeling of confidence and independence, we started what could be called a vertical integration, by doing just continually a little bit more ourselves. For instance, we used to hire different kinds of things done, and some of the early things we started doing ourselves was silk screen work, making our own transformers, coils, ultimately our own timing condensers. And we started investigations rather early in trying to make our own CRTs. We discovered fairly early from these efforts of making our own CRTs that it was placed us in a much better position to negotiate with RCA and Dumont, who are then supplying us with tubes. Because we could ask RCA to improve their tube, and they said, oh, no, you can't do that, and you can't do that. And we say, well, as a matter of fact, here's a way, maybe, have you tried this? And we were able to help them change the things that they were doing to give us better tubes. Also, in the early 50s, in our relationships with RCA, there used to be a continual argument about whether or not the tubes met our specifications or their specifications. Sometimes they would meet their specifications and not our specifications. So our people, at one stage of the game, were shipping oscilloscopes to RCA engineering departments that had tubes in them that met RCA specifications but did not meet our specifications. Then our field engineer would follow that oscilloscope and say to the user, now this tube meets your spec, not our spec. We shipped it to you because you can go to your people and get a decent tube. And your arguing with them may be more effective than our arguing with them. And that helped a little bit. Also, in 1950 is the time we started our area rep activity. This was obvious. It used to happen that everyone could get in the same room at the same time. And this was done fairly frequently, especially at a time when there was some item of significance or general interest, like someone would come back from a trade show and report on how the instruments went. And this was a very definite part of the attitude of the founders of the companies to continually keep everyone involved all the time. And these meetings were very helpful in doing that. But when the time came that you couldn't get everyone in the same room at the same time, then we had each work area appoint a rep, and those 10 or 12 people met in Jack Murdoch's office. And that was a very effective system of communication as a substitute for the one-on-one or the immediate group or the daily group communication. It's never as good as being able to get together as a small group, but it is the best substitute that we've ever seen. Now, there's some things that remain constant in this, and that is, I was a little bit amused last month and today to hear some of the same questions about some of the same subjects that we've heard from the beginning. That also gives you a little bit of constant. Those things are constant. It's a little bit of assurance, too, that, well, if those things are the most serious things people have to talk about, then we're not so bad off, maybe, as someone might think. The area rep system down through the years has also contributed another huge advantage, I think, that we don't talk about enough, and probably all of you sense. And that is the cross-communication between you people. It's generally considered as a communication of between supervision or between management and individuals or groups of individuals. But I think that one of the most effective things has been the cross-communication, and maybe an illustration of this was one thing we observed at the meeting last month, where one person was rather persistent in a line of questioning and a line of reasoning that was important to him. Very good. He's entitled to that. No one objected to that. But at the same time, another person said, there's another group of us who feel differently. Okay, the customer would have. This was an unlimited warranty on it. Of course, we gave away a few transformers on that, but nevertheless, this was indicative of the principles on which the business was based and the attitudes of the people. It was always based upon what is fair and equitable. This was what happened in the Court of Claims business. In 1958, the Signal Corps put out a request for bid. And they specified in that not Tektronix type 535 or equal, but they specified it really had to be a Tektronix type 535 oscilloscope. They specified the tube complement. Then they specified that the plug-in amplifiers had to work, regardless of whose amplifier was going in the hole. So that really their intent was to purchase the Tektronix 535 oscilloscope as manufactured by anyone. The cheaper, the better. Okay, Hickok got the bid. I immediately wrote him a letter and said, we want to let you know we have patents, and if you perform on this contract, that you'll be infringing our patents, and that we will expect to get the profits that we would have received had we gotten the business at our price. Okay, that started an administrative chain. pretty soon the Air Force was in on the act. They wanted a copy of our 545. They asked a Hickok to do it. Our field engineer looked at the production or the pre-production sample, and he said that this was not a copy of a Tektronix 545, but our field engineer said that this is a genuine, butchered-up original. Hickok had taken one of our instruments, modified it, the chassis fed back to the Air Force as a pre-production sample. We felt that this was improper on principle. Northeast Electronics was doing the same thing to Hewlett-Packard. They were copying Hewlett-Packard instruments in the Northeast commercial brochure. They had an actual photograph of a Hewlett-Packard instrument. And we said that this just can't go on. Hewlett-Packard didn't quite take the same attitude we did. In fact, Dave Packard made an unfortunate statement at one time that they, when they sold the instrument, they sold the drawings or some such thing, so that they were trapped. But we felt that we had to try to establish a principle because, number one, it was very bad as far as the United States government is concerned. They were not getting value received. I went back to find out if this was really the policy. And I went to the Signal Corps where we were during the war. A guy that used to work for me when he was a civilian and I was in the military was the guy that originated this. And he was one of the originator of the contracts. And yes, that was their policy. I went to Washington and said, is that your policy? They said, yes, that's our policy. We'll buy it from whoever we want. And we went to Congress and we said, what's the policy of the United States? And a staff member of the Senate Select Small Business Committee said, look, we give you these patents. Don't be so stupid to think that we're going to let you use these against us. We said, well, wait a minute now. You have to encourage the innovator. You can't encourage the copier, or where will the United States be 10, 15, 25 years from now? So this is on a basis of principle we wanted to turn them around. And one time I was back there and talking with Army patent people at the Pentagon, and I said, yeah, getting you people to change your mind is just like my standing here and pushing with my thumb on the Pentagon building expecting to move it. And the Signal Corps patent person said, well, now, wait a minute. You know that song about the billion kilowatt dam and the goat, button it, don't you? Yeah. Well, keep trying. Okay. Then we got them another time and we said, look, we're just country boys in the city. Do we have a good case? And one of these, a Signal Corps attorney, said, yeah, you guys have a pretty good case. Okay. We went across the river, hired an attorney, and filed a claim. Then for the first time in the history of the United States, they filed a counterclaim, claiming, that is accusing a citizen of the United States of using or misusing patents owned by the United States. Now, our whole patent theory is when the government owns patent, so the government gives you a patent, but when the government buys a patent or pays for engineering and gets a patent, then that belongs to the people. So that any citizen should have the right to any patent owned by the United States government. Well, the court came around and decided that that was true, and they threw out the counterclaim. So then we went through two trials, and we finally ended up at where we are today. I could bore you with details ad nauseum, but I think time is running out, and I have just 2 minutes, and I'm going to have to stop at this point. And I told Howard that if he just couldn't contain himself and had something to say to rebut anything that I said, why, I would give him that opportunity. So in all good faith now, Howard, do you have anything you would like to rebut? Okay, then is there any burning question that anyone has? Yes. For what? For winning? I don't know. One of the things in the introduction did not say is that I retired a year ago. And what burns me is that when the money comes in, I won't get any piece of it. That should be in I heard one of our someone say here some time ago that we should get paid off in a year. And the amount of money now they're talking about is something like in excess of $4 million plus interest from this time. And I think I'm correct, maybe Howard, you have a better idea. We have invested in it in court costs and attorney fees, something around $1 million. Does that go with your thought, Howard? We have as much as $1 million or not much more? Plus, we have invested in the court case something like, or something less than $1 million. We'll get something just under $5 million out of it. But the major change was, for the benefit of us, we've gotten far more money out of it over the years, is that the company, or the United States government changed its policy when the counterclaim was thrown out and stopped the copying. Now, this is the greatest benefit to the United States that there could be. First, it's also a considerable benefit to us at Tektronix. But first, it's the greatest benefit to the United States. Time is out, I think. Thank you.
I want to thank everyone for coming today. And before you leave, Norm Silver wanted me to announce that the question that was asked about the fluctuation of U.S. dollar overseas and its effect on Tech's business will be answered in the agenda. Thank you.